I'll call the meeting to order, and let's see if we have minutes. We have a quorum, and would somebody like to move the minutes from what's the date there?
I'm in the wrong one. They moved us down.
For Tuesday, February 27th, does anybody want to move the minutes?
I do. So move.
The Representative Dean has moved the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? By no. Nobody's opposed, so we've adopted the minutes. And today we just want a brief run-through of the governor's health care bill. There are sections of this bill, I think John Walz will go through it, but there are sections of this bill that are in Norris Lawick's committee, and so they will be removed from this bill eventually. And there are also sections that are in Representative Clark's committee, and so those will disappear someplace along the line. And for the members' information, I'm meeting with Senator Berglund on Friday, and I think we'll try to lay out a strategy about what's the vehicle for the big bill. And I think it's probably House File 297, I think is what she is, will probably intend to use, but that's not been decided yet. So that would mean that the features of this bill that we like will be incorporated into that other bill if that's the way it works out. So John, if you Walz, if you want to just sort of run through the budget and give us just a general sort of overview of what's in here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, John Walz, House Fiscal Staff. As you mentioned, House File 842 is the bill that outlines the governor's budget proposals for the area of health and human services. And as you also mentioned, there are a few items in this contained within this bill that fall under other committees' jurisdiction, and I'll try to point those out where they occur.
Yeah, John, if I could tell the members, there's another thing I also forgot, that the governor has the Healthy Connections bill, which is partly in here. That's his health care reform. That, I think, will be going as a separate bill. We're still waiting to get it out of the Finance Department with its fiscal note. And there also is a mental health section in this bill, and there's going to be a separate governor's mental health bill that will contain, I think this is Article 8 in this bill. So there will be definitely be some changes, and I don't think you need to spend too much time talking about the mental health initiative or the health insurance reform, because that'll be moving separately.
Mr. Chair, I'll be primarily just talking about the first 30 pages, which is the appropriation article. The rest is the policy details, and if there are questions, I would defer those to either the department or House research staff. So, Mr. Chair, beginning on page 2, we just have, first there's a summary of appropriations. You'll see the total spending for this bill is about $11.3 billion. This is roughly about half of the spending that occurs in this area. The other half is statutory. So these would just be encompassing the direct appropriations that go through this committee. Mr. Chair, moving down, let's skip to the bottom of the page is, again, a funding summary for the human services portion of this bill. The other dollars, of course, would be under the Department of Health. You'll see that there are many riders in the appropriations section. Most of these are of a technical nature. A lot of it is boilerplate language. I'm not going to go through every rider, but many of them are boilerplate language items that appear from year to year and are required to allow the agency to manage the programs and comply with federal regulations. There are also many pieces of rider language within this bill that talk about adjusting the bases of programs, and most of those are to adjust the bases for programs that the governor has an initiative in. And so if we did not do those initiatives, those riders would not appear, or if we did them at different amounts, the numbers would change. Mr. Chair, I'm going to some of these technical riders dealing with TANF continue from page 3 all the way until page looks like 8, and I'm going to skip ahead to page 7 and talk about mention that two of these riders have to do with the governor's. You see the one beginning on line 7.5 and another beginning on 7.17. Those riders deal with the governor's initiatives for TANF refinancing, which was freeing up some TANF dollars for general fund use, as well as MOE work participation initiatives that are covered within the governor's budget. And the second rider this on 717 deals with refinancing and some federal compliance for MOE regulation. Mr. Chair, going on to page 8, there is a rider at the top of the page which I'm told is boilerplate and allows the state, this is one titled Capitation Rate Increase, deals with the University of Minnesota. I'm told that's boilerplate language and allows the state to receive some additional federal match. Going down to the Health Care Access Fund transfer.
If I could, I'm not sure how this one works, but the members ought to know that there was a point in our history when the university wrote the state a check for, I think, $5 million at 10 minutes to midnight on a particular day, and the state wrote a check for $5 million back to the university at 10 minutes after midnight. And the federal government had to match that $5 million, which we got to keep. They're becoming a little stricter about how we do things like that. But that's what I think this relates to, those kinds of issues.
I believe so, Mr. Chair. I was given an explanation that was very technical, and I don't remember exactly what the explanation was, other than that it allowed us to pick up some federal money. Mr. Chair, continuing on line 8.9, the Health Care Access Fund transfer, a portion of this transfer is due to the governor's initiative on critical access dental. A portion of the transfer is due to his mental health initiative, and another portion of this transfer is due to the Section 125 plans under his Healthy Connections proposal. And so those numbers, of course, would change whether or not the committee decided to proceed with any or all of those initiatives. Mr. Chair, going down to the area of agency management takes care of, as we heard, many of the human resource functions and other functions of the agency. The amounts in agency management for financial operations, legal and regulation operations, management and information technology are listed there. And those totals that you see include two governor's initiatives, which we heard about before, for a study of fee alignment and another item for a background study for compliance with federal regulations. I believe they were background studies for foster care parents. Mr. Chair, moving down to the revenue and pass-through on line 9.18, those dollars encompass many pass-through appropriations, but primarily that deals with child support enforcement collections and payments in that area. Moving down to the item or the area of children and economic assistance grants, this area encompasses some child care items that are within the Early Childhood Committee, as well as refugee services grants and other children and economic assistance grants that are in Representative Clark's Housing and Health Committee. But it also includes It's where we find the majority of child care and welfare programs that are funded by the state, and where most of the TANF spending is done. In the governor's budget, there were several initiatives in the Children and Economic Assistance Grants area that would be buried within these numbers. Those are an MFIP federal compliance initiative, the continuation of MFIP for legal non-citizens, which was set to sunset at the end of the current biennium, an MFIP time limit and program violations sanction. There was the initiative for adoption assistance and relative custody assistance, the $40 million for the county case management federal funding loss, as well as the immigration status validation and certification. And I believe if we move to page 10, you'll see that there is there's a rider piece on line 10.4. I'm told that there was a previous appropriation of $250,000 to the Board of Trustees, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, to provide tuition waivers. That money has not been spent, and this is giving a cancellation if it is not used by the end of fiscal 2007, which the date would be June 30th of this year. Mr. Chair, on line 1022, you can see an example of what I talked about for a base adjustment rider. You'll see several of these throughout the appropriations article, and they're just adjusting base amounts for certain programs, and it's all tied to governor's initiatives. Mr. Chair, moving down to page 11, you'll see several pieces of rider language to deal with the governor's initiative on adoption and relative custody assistance. Moving ahead to page 12, you will see the rider language on line 12.13, which is the $40 million for the targeted case management aid to counties that I mentioned earlier. And this rider is notes that it's a one-time appropriation to help deal with that loss of federal funds. Mr. Chair, moving down to on page 13, I had a question earlier with the department about a rider language on line 13.16 for emergency general assistance, and told that's boilerplate and it's something that's been in the bill since 2003, just establishing a limit for that program. Mr. Chair, again, we're just seeing, going on to page 14, we're just seeing line items for specific programs until we get to subdivision 5 on 14.8, and these are the dollars that the department gets to administer all of the grants from the previous several pages. Mr. Chair, skipping ahead to page 15, on line 15.25, we enter the area of healthcare grants. This is where the funding for Minnesota Care, MA, and General Assistance Medicare falls. In the healthcare grant section, there's a major governor's initiative for Healthy Connections, which we heard about earlier, which establishes the Minnesota Care 2 and the exchange for citizens to buy private health insurance on a pre-tax basis. The dollars to set up the exchange are carried under the Department of Health later in this bill, but the rest of this proposal and most of the Minnesota True Care dollars would be within this area of the budget bill. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on to page 16. On line 1622, there's a rider for physician-directed care coordination, and this is some of the paper for performance Q-Care initiative that the government has. And just another thing I forgot to mention, other governor's initiatives within this program area of the department include the Healthy Connections, the Q-Care, the client medical access mileage adjustment, the extension of critical access dental and additional funding for citizenship documentation to verify that those applying on an annual basis for public health care are citizens of the state of Minnesota and eligible for Medicaid programs.
If I could just jump in for a second. That physician-directed care coordination is one of the governor's initiatives that's kind of similar to the testimony we had from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic and Park Nicollet, but it deals with a very small number of people. When you get to that, those change pages in the budget book, the governor's actually booking savings in the out years. So there are things that we can do that will improve quality of care and save money, and he's actually, they're relatively small because he's only dealing with a small population in this thing, but there are places I think we can save some money. And that's one of them. John.
Mr. Chair, skipping ahead to page 17, on line 17.2, the area of healthcare management, and that is just the agency's administrative money and all the folks that deal with administering the healthcare programs that the previous healthcare grant section funds. And then I'm going to skip ahead to page 18. Line 18.5 begins the program area of continuing care grants. We're essentially talking about long-term care for elderly and disabled primarily. Buried within these totals that you'll see are the governor's initiatives for the COLAs for long-term care facilities. That initiative was $92 million to provide COLAs of roughly 2% and 2% over the next 2 years to these long-term facilities. There was initiative for elderly waiver assisted living coverage. There was an initiative for home and community-based provider standards to try to set up standards which the different home and community-based service providers would be universal and they would all have to follow, as well as the governor's $45 million mental health initiative is also primarily contained within this program in the department.
Mr. Walls, is that why there's health care access money in this?
Mr. Chair, the governor is using health care access fund money for the mental health initiative primarily, as well as a few dollars for the HIV/AIDS initiative. About $3.4 million of that would be for the HIV/AIDS program. The balance of the other dollars would be for the mental health initiative. And Mr. Chair, in addition to that, there's also a $1.5 million initiative for the deafblind program, additional services for deafblind individuals, and expansion of the nursing home report card program.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wallace, is that $1.5 million? Is that on the biennium, or is that $1.5 million per year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is $1.5 million for the biennium, $562,000 in fiscal 08 and $938,000 in fiscal 09.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, on page 19, there is some rider language having to deal with the governor's initiative for, I believe that is the elderly waiver for assisted living coverage. There's on page 20, there's some language dealing with. That's where we'll find most of the funding for mental health grants. On page 21, some base adjustments dealing with the deafblind program on line 21.3. And moving down to line 21.27 is where we enter the area of state-operated services. These are essentially the NIDO program, the security hospital, and what's the other program? Mr. Chair, I'm forgetting what the third one is. And the sex offender program are contained within state service services, as well as some enterprise services. Mr. Chair, the governor's initiatives within this area, there's only one, and that was in a savings, actually, of $3 million from the general fund for the biennium, due to the fact that they had overestimated the number of people that would be within that facility this coming biennium, and they're going to be able to delay the opening of an additional living unit and save $3 million, and we heard testimony on that from the department. Mr. Chair, moving to page 23, we find the appropriations for the Commissioner of Health, and the Department of Health receives about $160-some million per year, of which about $20 million a year is funding under the jurisdiction of this committee. All that you see on page 23 and the top half of 24 is in the Housing and Health Committee. That would be Chairman Clark's committee. And on line 24.25, we see policy, quality, and compliance. This is the program area of the Department of Health that's under the jurisdiction of this committee. Within this funding, there are several initiatives that the governor has included. Those include using healthcare access money for e-health grants, and those grants are for medical record keeping and planning for electronic record keeping in urban and underserved urban areas and rural areas. Again, this was a healthcare access fund appropriation. There was an initiative with healthcare access fund of $16 million for the biennium for Merck federal compliance. There was going to be a loss of federal money in the Merck program due to some federal policy changes, and this was to try to mitigate the loss and secure $5 million additional federal dollars with $16 million from the state.
Mr. Walls, we have not paid for Merck out of the healthcare access fund prior to this.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we have. Mr. Chair, there's also the portion I mentioned earlier of the governor's Healthy Connections program, $12 million from the Healthcare Access Fund to set up the exchange where folks can purchase their pre-tax private health insurance.
John, if we could hold off for a second, I think the Department of Health may want to correct something.
Oh, sorry.
Every once in a while, I'm wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Margaret Tully with the Department of Health, and you picked up on my subtle body language today. We have in the past used healthcare access funds to finance medical education research costs, Merck. I think the first years in which we appropriated funding for Merck, it was the general fund. The following biennium, we added healthcare access funds. When the tobacco settlement came to the state, we eliminated general fund and healthcare access fund financing for Merck and put Merck into a tobacco endowment. When we eliminated the endowment, we put Merck into dedicated cigarette tax funds out of the general fund. That's the history.
Okay. Thank you. John, you can continue.
Mr. Chair, again, the $12 million is a one-time appropriation from the Healthcare Access Fund to to set up the exchange for the governor's healthy connections proposal. There's $600,000 for healthcare access survey. That is from the healthcare access fund. There's a long-term care and alternatives proposal, which is $822,000 from the special revenue fund. There's some housing service fee adjustments. We heard department testimony about several fee proposals, some with reductions and some with increases. There was a mortuary science fee proposal, an occupational therapy fee reduction, and a hearing instrument dispensing fee adjustment. Those dollars and proposals would all be contained in the policy, quality, and compliance area of the Department of Health. Those dollars in totals, along with rider language, appear on pages 24, 25, and the top of page 26. When you get down to line 26...
Representative Abler has a question.
Yeah, about back to the Department of Health fees, and this may be a question for you, maybe the department wants to answer it. I don't know how much time you want to spend, but I... this hearing aid dispenser fee, which went from $350 to $1,000, seems like a lot to me, and I'm... Do you know anything about that, Mr. Walls, or should I ask the department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, only what I heard in the testimony from the department itself.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it seems like a really extremely unreasonable increase in a fee for people who don't make all that much money. And so if we can get a breakdown, if the department wants to talk about it or if they want to, I know these are based upon services, but if it's 135 or so hearing aid dispensers, this is the increase to get them almost $180,000 in revenues needed to deal with whatever issues they have. And I'm just curious if they really need that much money, or that's my question and concern. How do you want to handle it is fine with me in terms of timing.
Well, if the, somebody from the department wants to come down, we talked a little bit about this before, but if they can refresh our minds on this issue.
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health. We are proposing a sizable increase on hearing instrument dispensers up to, I believe, the current fee is $180, an annual fee, and we're proposing to increase it to $1,000. And this would be on non-audiologists who would be certified to dispense a hearing aid. The number of people who are subject to the fee has decreased substantially in the last 4 years. The cost of administering the certification exam has increased in the last 2 years. And the cost of our investigation of complaints against hearing instrument dispensers has continued as it has in the past. We have always had a disproportionate number of complaints that we've needed to investigate against this profession compared to other professions. And not to suggest that those are that those are improper professional actions, but to simply say our workload is very high in this area, and the number of complaints compared to the number of professionals is sizable. And so the amount of money we spend in this area is in order to recover those costs, we need to set the fee at this level.
Representative Abler.
Well, I think I was involved, if not the author, at least involved in the people that split these out and did this. We've messed with this little niche of you off and on over the years, and there was some assurance that it wouldn't go this high, and this is a huge surprise to me. And had I known that we'd gone here, I would have, that was not anybody's imagination that it would be at this level. And I think if you could get to me a breakdown of every dollar that's spent relative to these things, I would like that. So I don't think this is conscionable, and I just don't think that if it's, we need to do some more work on this than just take it at face value, with all respect. I know you folks probably spend the money and put the effort out, but there has to be a better way. This is going to crush some of these folks, and actually they provide a very cost-effective, good service. And if we lose these practitioners, they'll go to more expensive places, and that's actually going to cost us money. So that's my speech for today, but I just you can get that from me, and I'll appreciate that.
Commissioner, if you could get us that and then get us comparable data from the audiologist hearing aid dispensers, the number of complaints, the number of people, so on.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question.
Representative,
which group was the one that wanted to split?
The audiologist.
I have to be familiar with this issue a little bit. But, they used to be licensed together for the hearing aid dispensing part of their business, and I forget the year, but we separated them so that the audiologist hearing aid dispensers are licensed separately now, and the hearing aid dispensers that are not audiologists are in their own group.
And Mr. Chair, which is the, did both groups come forward to want to do that, or did one or the other?
The initiative was pushed by the audiologists. Thank you, Commissioner. John?
Mr. Chair, just finishing up on page 26, you will see the line 26.4, the rider language for the health insurance exchange, and the rider language noting it's one time for setup of this exchange. After that, Mr. Chair, the rest of the Department of Health is within the Housing and Health Committee's jurisdiction, and that would take us to the policy language portion of the bill.
Okay. Are there any questions about the financial part of the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. And I'm sorry, I missed the beginnings of the discussion, but was there a general discussion of where the TANF money was, how that was going to be split up? Or could you kind of go over that for me a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the state receives its TANF block grant from the federal government, and there's expenditures within mainly the area of children and economic assistance grants, of which the department has roughly 15 budgetary areas, many of those containing TANF expenditures due to its flexibility. I'm not exactly sure what the base is under the child care portion that would be in the Early Childhood Committee. And I don't know that it's been determined sort of who will be the gatekeeper of TANF dollars so that we don't exceed the available funding. I think that's going to be a discussion with leadership when they set targets.
Just so that members understand, the in the past, some of the TANF is a block grant we get from the feds. It's supposed to be for basically for MFIP families. And some of that money in the past has been spent for daycare support. And so that happens to be now in Representative Slavik's committee. And some of the money has been spent on other items for MFIP families that fall under the jurisdiction of this committee. And so somehow leadership is going to have to sit down with Representative Slavik and Representative Huntley and decide who gets how much of the TANF money. And it will be an interesting discussion.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to add that according to Department of Finance, we are entering the 2008-09 biennium with an unspent balance in the TANF fund of about $46 million plus our annual block grant. The governor, I do have the governor's numbers, but I don't have before governor spending with me. His proposals take it down to 17 million, excuse me, 4 years from now. We're four million at the end of the 08-09 biennium with his recommended spending. But that also includes $72 million in TANF refinancing, which would transfer or free up $72 million of general fund for other spending.
Yeah, just follow up. Can you explain that in a little more detail, how that works?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, as you know, we receive a tenant block grant, and I'm not exactly sure what we receive every year. It's in the $263 million range, and we're required to do somewhere in the neighborhood of $180 of maintenance of effort or MOE spending on the state side. And these are expenditures that the federal government feels is appropriate for our support of those programs, or like programs for economic support and helping people reach self-sufficiency. And we currently spend more money than that, than the required minimum. And so the governor proposes using some of the unspent balance to replace general fund spending that the state does. And I believe primarily it's in the child care area. So we would replace over the next biennium $72 million of general fund base spending with TANF dollars, freeing up that $72 million to be spent elsewhere. In the future, once we've spent down that TANF balance, we'd have to replace that spending with general fund in the future, unless we had additional TANF dollars to use. But that's essentially what we're doing, is just freeing up general fund money by spending TANF dollars, because we would still be meeting the minimum maintenance of effort requirement.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Wells. I'm a little rusty on this, but I seem to recall that when TANF was created, it went from being an entitlement, so that if you hit an economic downturn like we had after 2001 or whatever, you know, people qualified would just automatically, the feds would give us the money. And as I understand it, we evolved to a block grant such that if we go into a serious economic downturn, continue to lose jobs, we will have to absorb any of that increased caseload within the TANF block grant that we get. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that question I would defer to the department. I believe that each state sets up its benefit set within certain criteria set forth by the federal government. And I don't know that we are at the bare minimum. I think we have set up our own set of criteria that you could change eligibility, I believe, to some extent to reach some savings. But I don't know what the state's ultimate responsibility would be, depending on how drastic that downturn is, and I would have to have the department respond to that.
If there's somebody from the department that this is an extremely complex issue, very difficult to understand.
While we're waiting for them, that was just, I wanted to kind of weigh a little bit about how far down we can take this reserve if we're potentially on the hook if we end up with increased eligibility over the next biennium, and what is an appropriate reserve balance.
My name is Steve Nelson. I work for the Department of Human Services in the Children and Family Services area. The question is about the block granting of the AFDC program originally. Originally, it was a federal entitlement that would rise and fall with the caseload. And TANF was block granted in the mid part of the 1990s. At a point when the amount of spending within that program was at the highest level. And so even though it's a fixed amount, and if caseload really went up, there might be some financial repercussions on the state. In fact, caseload has fallen quite a bit, and we are spending on the cash grant probably less than half of what we were spending in those peak years in 1993-94. So if the caseload did go up, we would, absent changing the parameters of the MFIP program, we would have to find some money to fund that. Back in maybe 2002, when the caseload was projected to go back up, and when we had a lot of TANF money dispersed in various uses across state agencies, we did pull the money back in and use some of it to fund the forecasted need. But that's the kind of thing that would need to be done if the same circumstance arose and there wasn't a TANF balance. Obviously, if there isn't a TANF balance and the caseload goes up, the forecast would push that spending onto the general fund, and then the legislature would need to look at that amount and determine whether they wanted to spend the money.
So, Mr. Nelson, then this is a federal entitlement program? I mean, to get onto MFIP?
It's technically not an entitlement to the person. The block grant itself is considered an entitlement to the state, but it does not increase when the caseload increases.
Yeah, I understand the caseload going up and down with the economy, but can we put our own limits on who's eligible for this program, or are those federal requirements?
We have quite a lot of leeway, Mr. Chairman, in how we establish eligibility and the level of benefits for the program. There's only a small category of mandated recipients that we would have to cover.
Representative Thiessen.
And with regard to that question, does the maintenance effort play into that, though, too? And is that where we're getting the borrowing of the money? Basically, that we're spending more of our state general fund stuff that would count towards maintenance of effort stuff, and we're going to now transfer TANF money to cover those things?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, what tends to happen is you've got an MFIP forecast that over the years has been fairly flat to decline, but you've got a child care forecast that keeps going up, and you have a circumstance where you tend in the out years especially to have more money in the child care program than you need to fully fund a TANF maintenance of effort need, because child care is one of the biggest sources of TANF maintenance of effort. And so that keeps growing, so it offers opportunities to do the refinancing from general fund onto TANF. Also, the maintenance of effort under TANF is read quite broadly. Not only does it include all the programs, all the types of programs that were under the old AFDC program, but it includes items like child care and some social services and education programs. And the biggest single non-old AFDC source of maintenance of effort is the Working Family Credit, which back in the early days of TANF was a very small amount, and now it exceeds $100 million, and that kind of program is allowed in TANF rules to be counted as maintenance of effort, and so those are the child care, working family credit, are the two main places where we look to do these sorts of TANF refinancing when there's extra maintenance of effort involved.
Mr. Nelson, could you just, the working family credit is basically in addition to the family's income. Could you, in the eligible range, could you tell us what that's for a typical family of four, let's say? Just a rough estimate of how much money that is for the family.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's been a while, but I think the maximum you can get under the working family credit might be about $1,100-$1,200 a year, and I can get back to you on some better figures on that. But it's in that range.
Thank you, Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, it'll be interesting to see about the TANF money, and you know that our bill is eventually rolled into your bill, the child care part, but certainly would be good if our committee could deal with that, to lobby you openly, or we'll talk with that more about leadership, but it's a big part of what we do in our committee. I think Representative Loeffler's point, as we're talking about eligibility, and I hope you all know we're wrestling in our committee with changing eligibility and get, so that more parents and more families can become eligible, and that does impact these funds. We did have testimony on this in our committee, and I think members know, I think it's been a precedence to the testifier what for 7 years we've taken the TANF funds and then put them into the programs and then taken that money and put it into the general fund. I asked Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson, I think he had said we've been doing this for about 7 years now. It is a practice, you know, members, that I think we need to really think about what we're doing. I mean, have the federal government giving us money for people that need it. I mean, this is TANF money, and then we're basically taking it, replacing it into those programs, and then taking money out of those programs. And it's kind of a, for lack of a better word, maybe sort of a laundering system is what it feels like, and I think we need to think about what we're doing and how we're doing it, particularly if we're going to increase eligibility. I mean, is that right? How many years have we done where we've done the TANF replacement?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, it seems to me it was around 1999 that the first little bit of refinancing happened.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
And then another question as far as the... If Minnesota does not meet its work participation rate target, then we start to get some penalties, right, in terms of the block grant. How does the governor deal with that? He has some strategies, right, for us to try to meet that, but if we don't, the first penalty is, what, 5% of the block grant, which is about $13 million? Is that correct?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, the penalties are a growing percentage of block grant that is an adjusted amount. So I think the first year is 5%, followed by 2%, followed by 2%, building on up to a maximum. But that amount is discounted by several factors, including how close you get to actually meeting the work participation rate. So it's kind of severity of failure that comes into play. The thing that we're looking at in the governor's proposal and our experience in the past years with penalties, because we have been subject to penalties, I think, 3 years in the past that through a corrective compliance system were forgiven, and so we're feeling that kind of steady progress can be our basis for appealing and neutralizing what penalties may come in the future, because these are work participation penalties, they're based on our actual performance, and there's a lot of data that has to be transferred to the federal government, and there's lags and they have to review it. There's opportunities to do corrective compliance plans. So even though we may miss a work participation rate in a certain year, it won't be for many years down the road till we may actually be subject to the penalty that is related to that. So we aren't booking any penalties in the budget horizon that we are looking
at. Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, there's penalties, we'll try to avoid them. If they do come, we really don't need to budget for them. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, the practice that we have used over many years in all of our human services programs is we don't book a penalty or a disallowance until it actually happens and has gone through whatever appeal or court process that we have available to us.
Okay, that's good to know. I mean, because I worry about us getting in a situation where we're not making some of these programs and then being behind in our budget if we're being penalized and required to pay.
Mr. Nelson, doesn't the governor have in this bill a proposal to move, probably politically incorrect, but some of the basic people that are basically unemployable out of MFIP so they just don't get counted against us and fund them through another state source?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The proposal is, I guess we would call them the harder to serve, basically moves them, keeps them in MFIP, but moves them out of the fiscal view of the federal government by taking them out of our MOE, and thus they don't get counted as part of our work participation. Last year, something similar was done in moving two-parent families that have an extraordinarily high work participation rate requirement of 90%, they were moved out of the federal TANF MOE program onto a non-MOE program, and that makes a big difference in terms of what our ultimate work participation rate and penalty exposure might be.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, again, just to clarify on the TANF, my understanding, again, is if we're not drawing down these federal dollars to help offset state health care and human services costs, we're going to have to backfill that with state dollars. So, I mean, we did these things frequently when we were on the city council here in St. Cloud. We would do this with state and federal dollars. This is a benefit to the state, correct? I'm hearing people very concerned that we're using federal dollars to offset state dollars when, in fact, we'd be kind of crazy not to, wouldn't we?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, that's a decision more for the policymakers.
Mr. Chair, just on that point, and I don't know if this has come up because I had to step on, I'm sorry, but I mean, the other thing that we need to consider here is we have these penalties that we could be facing, and so if we start shifting money to one thing, I mean, it may come quicker that we have to start backfilling some of this money depending on how we do with our what we were just discussing, and so I think that's part of the concern that people are raising here, that it's not just maybe a matter of shifting money around, but we actually may be losing dollars depending on how we do.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. That was half the point that I was going to say, Representative Thiessen. In addition to that, keep in mind the amount of changes we made to eligibility and coverage because we were in some budget crises. And so that $46 million could be utilized in servicing not just child care, but some of the other things, health care and things of that nature. So it's not a real $46 million that we're saving. We've made some drastic changes in policy in helping the most needed individuals in the state that this committee really needs to grapple around and realize that we shouldn't be backfilling. We shouldn't be, you know, we should be really looking at moving forward to get these individuals as much as being self-sufficient as possible. My other thing is going back to the conversation, the discussion that Representative Slawick and Mr. Chair, you had around individuals that are tough to get to comply because of their circumstances. Mr. Nelson, my first question is, can you give the committee an example so individuals are familiar with the types of individuals and families that we're talking about that have difficulties? And that we have to have special services for them?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I would need to call our policy person up.
Can we do that, Mr. Chair, please?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I'm Ann Sessoms from the Department of Human Services. The families that are in the governor's proposal that we would be moving to non-maintenance of effort funding so that they wouldn't affect the work participation rate are generally families that have a disability that either may not be severe enough to qualify for Social Security, supplemental security income, or they may actually still be in the process of applying for supplemental security income. It could be physical health, mental health, chemical health. It could be that their children have serious emotional disabilities or issues that keep them from being able to maintain employment. And so that's the primary focus.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you for that. I'm also curious to know what happens in the interim until we, you know, without this current change that the governor's proposing, what happens to these individuals now during the interim? Are they moving into sanctions? What are we doing to these people, these families?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, the governor's bill doesn't actually change how county staff interact with the families. So if a family is on MFIP now with these circumstances, the policy would require that they have some kind of modified plan that accounts for the fact that they probably are not able to work for the 20, 30, 40 hours a week, whatever would normally be expected depending on the age of the child. And while I can't assure you that no one is being sanctioned in these circumstances, the way the policy is, if the family reveals to the worker that they have these issues going on, the worker should be responding and developing an employment plan that reflects those circumstances and does not require them to be looking for work or whatever for the full period.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I think this piece is important to have. We do have families with circumstances that aren't able to comply. It's not that they don't want to comply, depending on their family circumstance. But one of the things that the governor's not able to do with this piece is, because just like you said, it's still up to the county and how they enforce it. And counties operate differently across the state. Many of our social workers and our caseworkers are overworked and overwhelmed by their caseloads. And so you don't always get that chance to sit down and have that long, detailed information period with a family to find out if they're really at hardship. Some of the families, it's easier to tell. You know, they might have a language barrier. They have a child that's already born with a known disability, or they have already a known disability. But while you're in that gray area period of trying to get disability recognized by the federal government, or trying to get that next level of trying to get the county to understand what your doctor has said as it relates to your medical situation, or a temporary situation that may just be a couple years, there's really nothing in law or statute that we're doing to make sure that these families in the gray area have some type of safety net to make sure that they're not being sanctioned. Because we're not just sanctioning a family or a parent. You know, we're sanctioning an entire family. Even if that parent gets sanctioned and he's still able to get that child grant, that's still a lot of money that's being taken out of a household, a lot of extra stress that's going on a family that could be avoided if we had some policies to help out our county.
Other questions? You know, that's all we have on the schedule, but if there's somebody in the audience who wants to comment on the governor's bill, that'd be fine as well.
Mr. Chair, just a quick kind of administrative question. Is there a spreadsheet that covers this? Should it be in a book here?
Mr. Walz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, are you referring specifically to the TANF refinancing or the governor's budget in general?
The budget in general. It's not just change items, but that's the whole detail kind of by account?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I can either have that information, I can bring it to you directly, or have something in the packets for members at the next hearing.
Either way, I think it would be helpful to have it in that form. If it's, I don't want you to do the more work, but if it's available, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, a spreadsheet of the governor's initiatives is available on the House Fiscal website. It's sort of a four-part spreadsheet that the department works with, and I've taken out the parts of, that are in the other committees. But I can get you both the initiatives, the bases for before initiatives, and the overall total in three different spreadsheets, whichever you'd like.
I'll talk to you.
Okay.
Thanks.
We'd appreciate that, John, if you could make copies for us and send them around. Again, is there anybody in the audience who would like to comment on the bill?
No big rush, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler, I think we have a very good audience. So with that, I will adjourn the meeting.
Oh, Mr. Chair?